I am ashamed to say that this is my first visit to Australia. As I have wasted the first 78 years of my life in other parts of the world, I am very glad indeed to have an opportunity of rectifying this omission, and I expect to learn a great deal during the weeks that I shall spend in your continent. I cannot at this moment give you my impressions of Australia, as I arrived too recently. I am therefore compelled to talk about matters in which Australia is connected with world events. 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, it might have been hoped by Australians that they would have been able to keep out of the complications and tragedies of the old world. Technical causes, however, have now made such a hope impossible. Australia is intimately integrated with the great problems of the world. It is not necessary to dwell upon this fact, which has been obvious to everybody since the Japanese were in Papua. Australia, in spite of the defeat of Japan, continues to be faced by two closely related problems. One is the problem of preserving Australia as a white man's country. The other is the problem of not becoming a satellite of Russia. These two are, for the moment, practically one problem, since Russian propaganda in Asia will invite the Asians to repeat the Japanese attempt with Russian assistance. But in the long run, they are different problems. The problem of Russia is immediate, and the steps to be taken by Australia are essentially the same as those to be taken by all other countries of Western civilization. The necessary steps are by this time pretty well recognized. Combination of the Western powers in a defensive alliance and simultaneous avoidance both of provocation and of appeasement. But when we look beyond the next few years, we are compelled to think out an Asian policy, and this is by no means easy. Misled by American ignorance, the West has taken an extraordinarily unwise line towards China. That at least is my opinion. The government of Chiang Kai-shek was corrupt and reactionary and refused all reforms, even those most necessary to Chinese well-being. In spite of this fact, the West supported the government of Chiang Kai-shek and made it evident to the Chinese that their only choice lay between reaction and communism. They chose communism, and if we regret the choice, we have mainly ourselves to blame. We must not repeat a similar error in other parts of Asia. Asia has undergone a great awakening. It contains vast populations of whom the immense majority are in abject poverty. It will no longer acquiesce, as it has had to do in the past, in a position of inferiority towards nations of European stock. If we allow communism to be identified with necessary reforms, we cannot hope in the long run to keep Asia on our side or even neutral. I must at this point interrupt my argument to say that I think Soviet propaganda wholly dishonest and deceptive, and that the benefits which the Kremlin offers to Asia will disappear as soon as they have done their propaganda work. We cannot, however, persuade Asia of this unless we genuinely offer something better than what Russia can give, or rather, what Russia can offer. In India, the sort of policy that I am recommending has been successfully carried through so far as politics are concerned, though there remains an immense work to be done on the economic side. In the countries intermediate between India and China, including Indonesia, everything is still more or less in doubt. Nehru speaks for these countries with a voice which is not quite that of Western Europeans, but from which I think we of Western civilization have much to learn. If we do not secure the friendship of the countries of Eastern Asia, we shall, I fear, incur their enmity. And if we incur their enmity, we give an immense accession of strength to Russian imperialism, which will be disguised as championship of the oppressed. We have made this mistake already in China, but I cannot believe that the bad results of American policy in China are irretrievable. The Chinese are the most individualistic people in the world. They are also people with a very considerable national pride. I am convinced that as soon as Moscow attempts to tighten the reins, Titoism will develop in China. Provided always that the West is not offering an irreconcilable hostility. The problem of preserving Australia as a white man's country depends in the long run upon a solution of the economic problems of Eastern Asia. India and China, between them, have about 100 times the population of Australia. They are densely overpopulated and urgently desirous of opportunities of emigration. Only force can keep them out of Australia, force or the threat of force, until such time as their own economic problems have been solved. We ought, therefore, to do everything in our power to develop industry in Eastern Asia and to see to it that the enormous gap which now exists between the standard of life in India or China and the standard of life in Australia or the United States is progressively lessened. This was the wholly admirable purpose of Truman's fourth point, but it does not look as if America would do anything effective to carry out his policy in this respect. This is one of those cases, not so infrequent as many people think, where self-preservation demands doing good to our neighbors. Men are so accustomed to rivalry and competition that they tend to think that whatever damages others must be an advantage to themselves. This happens to be untrue. And the case of Asian poverty is perhaps the most notable example of its untruth in the present day. But at this point, I must make a very important proviso. I do not wish to see the standard of life in backward countries raised by methods which involve lowering the standard of life in more developed countries. We of Western civilization have made certain discoveries of immense importance to ourselves at present and to all mankind in a foreseeable future. We have found out how to eliminate abject poverty almost entirely, how to diminish illness and the death rate, to a degree that would have been inconceivable to our grandfathers, and how to give the material conditions of happiness not only to a favored few, but to almost everybody. These are new and immense boons, new in the whole history of mankind, and I do not wish to see the way of life which has made them possible disappearing from the world. We have, therefore, every right to be defensive as regards our own civilization. And in the long run, it is for the good of backward nations that we should be so, since the technical possibility now exists of gradually raising them to our economic level. And that technical possibility is not likely to be raised if, in the meantime, our present economic level is lost. This brings me to another subject, about which I hope to learn much while I am in Australia. The greater part of Australia at present is almost or quite barren. I am totally unable to believe that it is beyond the power of science to remedy this. If as much money and brains went into making Australia fertile as has gone into the construction of the atomic bomb and is going into the construction of the hydrogen bomb, I cannot but think that the result would be equally spectacular and considerably more beneficial to mankind. The problem of making rain is on the verge of solution, and if all Australia could be made rainy, a large part of the problem would be solved. There are, I know, other obstacles, which are at the moment quite as grave as lack of rainfall. There are large areas where the soil lacks necessary ingredients. But why should we sit down under such a circumstance? If science teaches anything, it is that there are very few circumstances under which it is necessary to sit down passively. Have we not discovered how to transmute elements? Is there any reason why radioactive atoms should not be used to alter the chemical constitution of the soil in a beneficial manner? I am speaking of something about which I am ignorant, and I have little doubt that most experts would poo-poo my hopes. This, however, leaves me unmoved. Experts always poo-poo whatever is two moves ahead and confine their vision to what is one move ahead. If Australia could support a population of 50 millions, the danger of being overwhelmed from Asia would be enormously diminished. If I could control Australian policy, I should establish a college of highly skilled scientists of various sorts, meteorologists, agronomists, nuclear physicists, and so on, to be engaged permanently in a theoretical investigation of what is necessary to increase the fertile area of Australia. The men concerned should mostly be young. They should be temperamentally hopeful. They should be respected because of their potential power. We hear much nowadays about the evil effects of science and the threat of radioactive disintegration. These evil effects are due to the use that politicians make of science. But the same skill which shows us how to exterminate the human race, if that is what we want to do, can also show us how to make the desert blossom like the rose, if we have the common sense to prefer that. It may be said that all the troubles from which the world is suffering are due to the fact that politics lags behind science and technique. Technically, the world is unified. Politically, it is divided into many separate nations and, above all, into two immensely powerful groups, each of which imagines that its own welfare is to be secured by the overthrow of the other. Whatever may have been true in the past, this is no longer true in our day. I do not mean to suggest that in no circumstances is war necessary. It is only too easy to imagine behavior on the part of Russia to which it would be folly to submit. But in view of the two wars that we have already experienced, it must be obvious that even the victors at the end of a great war have a far lower level of well-being than they had at the beginning. War can only result from folly on one side, or folly on the other, or, more frequently, folly on both. Even when the folly of one side has forced war on the other, war can, at best, preserve some of the things that we value. It cannot positively be creative of good things. We must, therefore, seek to avoid war, if we can do so without treachery to what we value in our way of life. And certainly one of the surest ways of avoiding war is to raise the economic level wherever we have power to do so. communism thrives on misery. And if anywhere in the world we can produce prosperity, we have to that degree diminished the power of communism, and we have done so not by creating a rival tyranny, nor by the threat of atomic extermination, but by measures which are good in themselves, quite independently of the great conflict between Russia and the West. We must not let our thoughts be warped by danger into a warlike or restrictive shape. We must, even in these difficult times, think constructively with a view to creation and not merely to preservation. So long as we think only of preservation, we shall develop a Maginot Line mentality, and we shall seem to be surrendering initiative to the enemy. When we see communists attacking something which we know to be an evil, we must not, because they attack it, rush to its defense. In some countries in Eastern Europe, aristocratic landowners kept peasants miserable without themselves doing anything useful. The Bolsheviks abolished this state of affairs. The West, I am sorry to say, while it had the power, did not. It is this sort of thing which gives plausibility to communist propaganda. Because the communists proclaim themselves the party of progress, which incidentally they are not, their opponents are too apt to think that every advocate of progress is more or less of a communist. This attitude has become regrettably common in America, not, I think, in the administration, but in Congress and in large sections of the population. This is not the way in which we ought to think or feel. We ought to have a vision as dynamic, as hopeful, as that of the most visionary among communists. We ought to be vividly aware of what has been achieved in the West and could be achieved everywhere in the direction of freedom and well-being and economic justice. We ought to be inspired by the clear possibility which modern technique opens to us of a far greater progress in these same directions, by the thought of a life free from fear, free from want, free from the appalling horror of war, in which the whole human family shall at last cooperate and the foolish enmities of our time shall appear as the nightmare obsessions of a barbarous age. It is in the spirit of this hope, and because communism makes such a hope impossible, that our propaganda should be carried on, and it is by such a hope that our lives should be inspired. Only a little wisdom is required to create a world happier than that of any former time. But if that wisdom is to prevail, it must be not through fear, but through hope.